Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Rebecca Barry. Barry is the author of the bestseller Later at the Bar, a novel in stories, which was also a New York Times notable book. Her most recent is a very funny and touching Recipes for a Beautiful Life, a memoir in stories. It was published by Simon & Schuster in April of this year. Barry's nonfiction has appeared in many publications and magazines, including the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post Magazine, 17, and Oh, the Oprah Magazine. Her fiction has appeared in Plowshares, Tin House, and the Mid-American Review. She is also a blogger, writing coach, and co-founder of the magazine Fresh Dirt. And welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, and you know, when I first heard about your book, Recipes for a Beautiful Life, I thought, oh God, no, not another sassy book about leaning in and raising kids. But this book was really inspiring. I was really pleasantly surprised. Now, tell us how it became what it is. Did it start off as blog pieces and journal entries?
It did start off as blog pieces. I had a blog called The Main Street Diaries that I was writing in part because I was working on this novel that appears in the book as kind of a major, sort of like the antagonist. Uh-huh. And I was doing the blog because I'm a visual person, but I'm not a person who takes a lot of photographs. And to me, these snapshots of what was happening with my children around me were so funny that I would just write them down. And it was a place my writing really had freedom. So I really enjoyed the blog. And it was almost like a daily practice where I'd write the blog and then go on to my, quote, real writing, which was the novel. So that's how it started. And then in the end, I sort of felt like that's where all the life in the writing was. So uh-huh. That's how it turned into a book.
But you didn't know at first that this was going to become a big public piece.
I didn't. I think that when you're an artist or a writer or whatever, you are a creative being, there is an antenna that goes up where you know something you're working on is going to become something. And I knew it was going to become something. I didn't know what it was going to become. And there were a lot of things that kept me from trying to turn it into anything because, you know, when I would say, I know the novel's really causing trouble, but the blog is really exciting and I really like that. And people would say, oh God, no, not another parenting book. The market is saturated.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
even bother.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a part of me that felt like all I could do was have this private space and not do anything with it. And in a way that gave it much more light and energy because
and
it felt
freedom.
Private. And freedom,
and you
absolutely.
Had the freedom. You can feel the freedom running
yeah.
through this book that,
yeah.
that you were not self-conscious about what you were writing at all. Now set up the scene the way you did for the beginning of the book. You and your husband left high-powered jobs in New York to move back to a small town, and you were going to write a novel, and this is where the beautiful life begins, right?
Yeah, well, I was actually in graduate school, so I was in Columbus, so it wasn't quite a high-powered job, but I did have a career as a writer for national publications, you know, national magazines. Uh-huh. And Tommy was working at People magazine. He had a part-time job there. And so, but we really, when I finished graduate school, the question was, where do we go? And it was like, go back to New York and stay in magazines and go the high-powered path or go someplace else. And I took one look at a six-week-old baby and was said, I cannot do this myself. I am going back to where my family is. But also, we really had an idea of the kind of life we wanted. We were very conscious of how we wanted to live, and it just seemed like this was the place to come. And we had this idea at the time of it being a beautiful life. You know, we were seeing all this mythology around, you know, people who had left such and such a job or moved into such and such a space in Brooklyn and made something amazing. And we thought, oh, we'll buy an old house and make it amazing. You know, and end up in the style section or this old house. It'll be amazing. So we really, in some ways in our brains, I feel like the aesthetics were part of it. But in the end, what we really wanted was a creative life. We didn't know that at the time. We thought we wanted a beautiful life, which we have.
Uh-huh.
But our beauty was not so much this idea that everybody has of the perfect studio in the country and all of that.
That's house and gardens.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really our idea was just to be as creative as possible. And we couldn't have imagined that, really. We had an idea, but we didn't know how much that would flourish.
Yeah.
We had no idea. And we didn't know. I mean, I went back to New York a while ago, and I was talking to someone, and I realized that my skill set had grown. Everybody thinks you leave New York, you leave the earth in a way. And in a way,
yeah.
we did leave publishing,
uh-huh.
you know. But I was talking to someone I used to work with in magazines, and I realized that my skill set had just grown exponentially since I left. And part of it was because I really dedicated my life to this artistic, creative path. And we knew we could do that here.
Yeah, I can understand that because, you know, a lot of the beautiful lives we hear about in New York and the big cities are disappointed people who are maxing out their credit cards, frankly.
Oh, we had disappointments maxed out credit cards. We had that, too.
But they end up in the style section anyway, and right. We're all supposed to be jealous, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm jealous of them, too, but it is the same. I mean, I think that's part of it is the disappointment and the maxing out, and that's how you get to who you really are, as you figure out what you thought you would be that you aren't.
And you find a place to be comfortable.
Yep.
Yeah, and you obviously have in this book. It's wonderful. Now, obviously, a memoir like this includes a whole bunch of other people's lives. Mm-hmm. And how did you let people know they were going to be in your book? Did you change names? Did you talk to people?
Huh? I changed a lot of names. I showed it to everybody, took a lot of stuff out that I felt like would encroach on privacy. I feel like there's no way to write about people and not encroach on privacy. So that's a hard thing to wrestle with when you're creating something.
That is hard to navigate. I've talked to a lot of people who write memoir, and they're mainly worried about their, you know, their immediate family's reaction.
Oh, my immediate family didn't care.
Really?
Yeah, it's so funny. None of us. I don't know what it is with us. Everybody read it. Everybody was fine. Nobody. I mean, that was the least of my worries, because when I showed it to them, well, everybody who I showed it to, I said, if you want me to change something, if it makes you uncomfortable, I'll change it. I felt like that was really important, because in the way, the whole town is a character
in
the book.
Exactly, yeah.
So you kind of have to honor that. But I'm sure I trespassed. You know, I'm sure.
Well, you know what? You have this keen eye, and you seem to have this sweet spirit about people, because to me, this is a culture that's gotten really mean. Mm-hmm. And even when you're criticizing, you don't seem to be getting mean. There's no reason to be, as far as I'm concerned. So that's perhaps why the community isn't coming at you now for what you've
written. That I know of. Well, there's so much love in that book. I mean, that book was just, I love my town. I love it. That book was all about just seeing the prosperity. It's a magical place.
And there's a comfort level here, too, that I found, too. I moved from a big city, as you know, and I found it so much more comfortable here.
Yeah.
And it was so stressful in the big city, for me at least, the noise and the craziness and trying to make ends meet. And it's a comfort level, and I can sense that in your book, which is really interesting to me. Now, when somebody's writing a blog constantly about their lives, did you find yourself having to interrupt what you were doing at the moment and run off and write some of this stuff?
Sometimes, although I remember at one point somebody brought a really beautiful pie to a party, and I looked at it and I said, look at that. Give me the recipe. I'll put it on my blog. And somebody else at the party said, you're interrupting the party to make a beautiful moment. And it did. It stopped me right there. And so I'd really tried not to do that.
Yeah.
The writing of things. And part of that is that I don't take pictures. So I didn't have to stop and capture it. Mostly I would go home and write stuff down in my private time.
Yeah, well, that's good, because, you know, I do notice that there are a lot of writers that do seem to keep themselves separate from life in order to write. You know, they almost put up a wall.
Well, yeah, because you have to be so sensitive.
Yeah.
And then you put your heart out there, and everybody, you know, you're like, here's the present I made. And some people are like, I hate that present. I want it to go back.
But you had to keep yourself open and vulnerable in some ways to write this book,
it seems to me. Yeah, I did.
That's what I found so fascinating. Now, you do have a bunch of recipes in this book, which I thought was a great way to sort of break the chapters and give us a little funny insight. I loved Angry Mommy Tea. That pulled me in. Tell them what Angry Mommy Tea is. It's perfect.
It's chamomile tea, water, lemon, and whiskey.
And honey.
And honey. Right.
You said it was good for your throat.
It's good for your throat, especially if you're screaming at everybody.
Tell me, Rebecca, did you actually do these recipes and use them? I mean, did you make Angry Mommy Tea sometimes?
Oh, of course.
During the day?
Oh, not during. Well, maybe. I don't know. That's none of your business.
Uh-oh, we need one now.
Right.
Now, are you hoping that your sons will be forgiving when they finally read this book? I mean, you portray them in pretty intimate detail.
Yeah. Writing the book was not hard. Crafting the narrative arc was difficult, and releasing it was very hard. I mean, I tried to pull that book back a million times.
Really?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I was very anxious about it. Even though everybody had read it, you know, you never know. It's one thing to read it before it comes out. It's another thing to see yourself in a book on the page, and myself included. I didn't know what the reactions were going to be like. And, you know, it talks about everything, my marriage, my family, my children.
Yeah.
And my children were a huge concern. So there were things that I took out of the book that probably would have made it a better book, but I felt like it would have hurt someone I loved or a family member or my children, and so I didn't include them.
God, I don't see how this book could be better.
Oh, and
it really was. I was really quite impressed by it.
Thanks.
It's really touching, and it is funny. I laughed out loud a few times.
Oh, good.
I hardly ever do.
I really wanted that to happen. I'm so happy to hear that. That's great.
Now, you know, I usually steer clear of books that say they're going to be funny and humorous and stuff. So where did your humor come from? You know, there is a lot of serious stuff in this book, and you seem to have this way to find humor in so many things. Was it your family, your upbringing, your temperament? Where'd you find that stuff?
Well, you know, I have a very funny family. I have a great mom and a great dad, and my mother laughs. I mean, once my brother-in-law, Peter, said, you know what I love about your mom is, like, she's one of the few people who still laughs at Bumstead and, you know, Dagwood Bumstead.
Yeah.
Like, she really does. And my sisters laugh a lot. And so one of my great pleasures in life as a child was making my family laugh because they laugh a lot. And then I also think people and the world is a very funny place. Like when I'm at my best self, as my best self, I feel like I just see how funny everything is.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go down into more brooding places, I don't think anything is funny. But that is a really alive part of me.
Yeah.
That just the world is really funny. I mean, it is.
Well, it is.
People are funny.
But you know, a lot of people try to be cute with humor. And they try too hard, and I didn't see any of that in this.
Oh, good.
You know, almost like stand-up comedy kind of stuff, where, look at me, I'm funny.
Yeah.
But you didn't do that in this book. I found it actually quite remarkable.
Well, I think that's because I wasn't trying to write for an audience when the original pieces were written. It really did come from my most private writing, even though it was a blog. Like, 3 people subscribed to my blog, so it was a very small, it had a small audience. Mm-hmm. And then the journals, nobody had seen, you know, so that writing was very natural. So I think that allowed the humor to come through in a way I wasn't trying to please people, although I'm so happy when people tell me it made them laugh.
Oh,
that makes
me
really happy.
What was your compulsion to write in the beginning? Do you remember? Did you start writing as a kid?
Yeah, I did. But, you know, I didn't really embrace writing until my mid-20s. I majored in French in college. I went to Cornell. I majored in French. I went to San Francisco. I thought I'd become a diplomat, which is hilarious.
Really?
Yeah, if you knew me better, you'd be like, no, you'd be terrible at that job. But I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. But then I decided to move to New York City and I wanted to write for magazines. It just came and then I did it. And then from there, I really like the short, manageable form. I feel like my whole career has been me getting closer to this kind of vignette-driven writing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is a culture that likes short, you know, I mean, there is a short attention span.
Yeah.
So you are able to fill in a lot in your short writing.
Yeah, my short pieces cover a lot of ground.
Yeah. What kind of things were you writing for women's magazines? I mean, is this an extension of that? You were writing advice, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
the hilarious thing about the women's magazines was this is sort of my answer to that time period in my life, because I loved writing for women's magazines and I loved living in New York City. I loved all of it. I wrote stories for women like on how to manage your life and how to, you know, what the solutions are to your very messy life. And what would always happen was I'd be writing an article and it would be, you know, how to get along with your family and I would fight with everybody in my family. Or it would be, you know, how to manage gossip and I'd say something and I'd get caught. It would happen every time. And so the reason I chose the how-to titles for all the chapters was that this was my way to take what was really happening in my life and narrate on that instead of telling the story of how to fix it. And so, for instance, the how to get your children to go to sleep chapters, my children do not go to sleep. And they still don't. Nobody in our family likes to sleep. So the magazine writing sort of prepped me for that. It allowed me to see sort of what we aren't looking at when we go to our your life is a problem, here's how to fix it culture. You know, we're always doing that. That's what women's magazines are.
It's,
that's the ethos in all of them. And I just don't think anybody's life is really a problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rebecca Berry. We're talking about her book, Recipes for a Beautiful Life, a Memoir in Stories. You know, it seems to me that these short chapters are a result of the experience that you have gone through. And probably when you were writing advice, you were making it up.
Not always. I mean, I've always been sort of someone who likes to give people advice. But we did, the way they worked in women's magazines, I actually found this very frustrating. I would have to call people who were experts and interview them, and so that's how it worked. There's a real formula for those pieces. And sometimes I would just want to write my own advice, which would sometimes be something like, I don't know, go to a bar, get drunk, like, try that.
I like that kind of advice.
Me too.
The best.
Me too. It's my favorite. So I didn't have to make things up because we had, and I think, the magazine culture has changed a little bit, but I mean, there was a very strict, not strict, but easy formula. You know, you interview three experts in the area. If you're doing a piece on how to handle jealousy, you interview a psychotherapist, someone who's written a book. You'd find another expert, but they'd have to be people whose advice was grounded in some kind of institution.
And
then you'd interview them, and then I would take what they said and weave it into a story, into a piece.
Then you should interview somebody who followed that advice and see what happened.
We did. There was always you had to interview at least three real people. And so, you know, there was a formula, and I got really good at that formula. It's a great formula. It works.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I bet my listeners didn't either. You know, I always thought it was just somebody, you know, egotistical enough in some cases to think that they knew everything, you know.
Yeah. You know, if you look at and I don't know what they're like now. I haven't read any of those. I haven't read them in a while. But if you look at the pieces, you can see a lot of them start out with a personal anecdote. So you think it's going to be the narrator's, the narrator is giving the advice. But then when you go in, you see how other people are feeding the advice.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Now, a little inside information.
You talk about the fact that you were working on a novel when you decided to switch to this memoir formula. What happened to the novel, and how did this change your way of writing by abandoning that and doing this?
Well, that was so hard. And now, looking back on it, because I see how it was the right thing to do, it doesn't hurt anymore the way it did. But when I had to put that novel down, it was just really sad for me. And it's hard to explain how sad that is to anybody who doesn't write or doesn't, what to compare it to. Mm-hmm. But I just had never tried so hard at something artistic and just not been able to make it work.
And so this was decided because it was rejected and an editor didn't like it,
We both came. I mean, I called my editor and she said, okay, it's good. Everybody thought it was good. It was good. It was good enough. But I knew that it wasn't the right form for the material, and I knew that there wasn't any of my soul in it. And I felt myself, while I was working on it, writing away from my soul with every plot twist.
Wow.
And it was killing me. I mean, I see this now way more clearly than I did in the book. In the book, I couldn't, even when I was finishing this book, I couldn't see it. But now I see very clearly that the material I was drawing from the novel was a lot like this material, but I couldn't do it as nonfiction. Too many people were involved. It's not the right, it wouldn't have been the right way to go. So what I wanted to do was unpublishable. And so we kept trying to turn it into a novel, and there was a point where my editor said, you know, okay, it's good, here's what you have to do. And I just remember as she was talking, her fixes were totally smart, and they were manageable, but something in me just shut down. I could feel all these parts of myself shutting down, and I just said, I hate this book, it has no soul. And she went, yeah.
Wow.
So
well, what a revelation,
that,
though, in some ways.
Yeah.
Because you could have just kept going.
Right.
You know, lifelessly and heartlessly.
Right.
And trying to, you know, just say, yes.
We could have published it. It would have been fine. It would have been a fine book. It would have been a book that, but I don't want to publish that kind of a book. It really didn't have any juice in it. It just didn't. It was you could feel the writer plodding along.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It just didn't
have formula kind of thing.
Yeah.
So do you think you'll ever write a novel again, or are you on a road?
Yeah, I just got a contract to write another novel. But this one is it's one of those novels where you know, they come up with a plot and you write the story. So it's more of a packaging deal. It's a partnership.
Oh, how interesting.
So that's fine. You know, that's more of that I'm totally excited about that project. I think it's going to be really fun. I love the collaborative part of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, part of writing books for me, the part that's hard for me is I love magazines because it's a collaborative effort and you're working with all these people towards a shared vision. But books are so lonely.
Yeah.
You know.
You say that in the book, too.
Yeah. They're lonely for me. I don't think, you know, I think for some people they're not lonely at all. But for me, they're kind of lonely. So I like this collaboration and this new book deal.
Yeah. Now, you know, I enjoyed your book also because I live in this area, but you did make Trumansburg, Ithaca, this area, one of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talk to us about that.
It is a character.
Yeah.
It's a very alive magical, wonderful place. I mean, this landscape, it's moving. There's something that informs, the water informs everything. The colors inform everything. It's such a beautiful area, and it always has been that for me. Even as a child, I grew up in Lansing, uh-huh. Yeah, and I spent a lot of time. I worked on a farm as a child, there's a wonderful family I worked with, and so I spent a lot of time outside, and I loved it, and I spent a lot of time roaming around, and I just love this area so much. So for me, it's very alive in spirit. You know, its spirit is very alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I connect. It's a big part of, it's where my stories are.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always felt that.
Yeah, and I know people who couldn't wait to leave here that I, met elsewhere who were from upstate New York. So you really connected with the whole spirit and the community. And do you feel like you were lucky to have met the right people? You know, some people feel isolated in small towns.
Well, it's all true. It's all true for different people. For me, there's a real calling here. I don't know why that is, but it is. I can totally see why people would want to get out.
Yeah.
It's just where you're drawn. But for me, it's very, I feel very lucky.
Yeah, I know this is a beautiful place. It brings out the creativity in people, seems to me.
Yeah.
Because it's not so rural that there's nothing going on. I mean, we have this incredible food scene, mm-hmm. and music scene, mm-hmm. and literary scene. And now, before we finish this interview, I have to talk to you about Fresh Dirt.
Oh, yeah.
The magazine you and your husband co-founded.
Yeah.
Tell us about it. Where did it come from? Where's it going? What's happening with it?
Well, Tommy always had that idea. I mean, even before we moved here, Tommy had this idea of doing a green living magazine. And it was before they had started cropping up. He just always felt like the mainstream culture that we have is kind of insane. And the progressive culture, at least in terms of sustainability, is actually the sane way for us to go. So he really, without hitting anybody over the head, because he's a very centrist person, so he really feels like there's a way to be insane with the progressive stuff too, but he really felt like if there was a way to move the progressive thought into the mainstream culture, it would be healthier for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So and we both had backgrounds in national magazines, and we loved them. We love them. We love the form.
Oh, yeah. I love magazines, too. Yeah.
You can do so much in a magazine that you can't do, say, in a book or a blog. Or there's just a lot you can do. So we loved the portraiture aspect of it. We loved the short piece aspect of it. We loved the way you can write about people. And we knew the formulas. So Tommy always had this idea to make a national magazine. And then when we moved here, we felt like, well, this is where everything's happening. All the stuff we want to write about is here. So the original idea was to make it a national, and then the opportunity opened up at Ithaca College to start it as a local, which was wonderful. I mean, that was such a great thing. And so we did that, and then after that happened, it didn't get funded the second time around because everybody left who was funding that part of the program. So then we did it ourselves, and we came out with we did four issues, and now we're sort of looking at what's next with it.
Well, to tell people what the theme is, though, it talks about food and sustainability. And
yeah, the theme is really a profile-driven magazine about green living. So it's not rooted. Both of us really feel like the green movement is much bigger than food and
farming
and all that. It's everything. It's about the way you think.
It needs to be about everything.
It needs to be about everything. And so our last issue was the creativity issue, because it was sort of like, we're going to have to be, this movement is going to require creative thinking. And that's such a buzzword right now, but the creative thinking that we're going to need is going to be the kind of thinking where you really look inside and think about what kind of a world you want to live in and then try to create that. So we are really trying to show all the different aspects of how people are doing that. And we do it through profiles because we believe that it's better to tell someone's story than go issue. Like, I don't like going from the issue out because I feel like then you're caught in the fight.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just show someone who's doing it, then you show someone who's doing it. And it's not, we're not saying you have to be like this. It's just like, here's someone who's doing this.
Yeah, and it shows people you don't have to have a special anything to.
Right.
Your neighbors are doing this, right?
Yeah, I mean, we really liked. That's one thing we've loved about it is that we just really loved the way it makes ordinary lives really extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, I love that in general. How the extraordinary and the ordinary is my favorite approach to.
And I got the inaugural copy of it. They somehow Ithaca College sent it to me.
Oh yeah.
And I was so impressed. And
great.
Of course, I didn't know who you were, who anybody was, and I wondered what was going on.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. It was a beautifully produced magazine.
Well, we've had great designers. I mean, Robin Wishna is our art director, and she's an amazing photographer. And then we had Allison Yusavage for a while was the designer, and then Jill Lamar did the last one. So we've just had great visual people.
Yeah,
which is really wonderful.
I think it's a great idea. I kept thinking for the last few years, we've got to start doing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't working. Look at how mean and angry everybody is.
Right, and that's when you get caught. If you just sort of step back and say, well, I think this is really beautiful and I like this person's story, that pulls you back from the fight of, if people are getting mean because the stakes are high, and that's not made up. People are, it's scary for those of us who feel like we're losing the land, and it's aggravating for people who feel like that hurts their way of thinking or their money or whatever it is. So the stakes are high.
Yeah, they are. Well, Rebecca, we're almost out of time. I have one final question. Your book is so friendly and open and wonderful. What happens at readings? Does everybody want to be your best friend? Or are you getting into that where everybody thinks that you're their best friend?
Well, I've only done readings here, so I'm already best friends with everybody.
It's
so great.
But I know how those friendly kinds of books like yours make people think, oh, I want to know her. I want,
I kind of love that. I like to have a lot of friends. So for me, it's really nice. It doesn't faze me. I really, really enjoy people.
I think that is so great. So the book fits with the person because a lot of writers are private and they really don't like to do the publicity. And that's wonderful. I think that's great.
Thanks.
It's an honest book. It's a real book.
Thanks.
I do hope people will go out and buy this book. It's called Recipes for a Beautiful Life, a Memoir in Stories. And we're almost out of time. Can you give contact information, your blog, how people can get in touch with you?
Yeah, I have a website called recipesforabeautifullife.com. I also have, I think my old website, RebeccaBerry.net, is also still up. So both of those websites have contact. There's a contact place. Uh-huh. I think the contact is hello@recipesforabeautifullife.com is a way to contact me.
I'm sure people will find it. Are you doing any readings later in the fall?
Nothing scheduled. I'm doing one in Peterborough, New Hampshire in October. And I think I'm going to be doing one in November in San Francisco.
Oh, good.
So that'll be fun. I'll be in your old stomping grounds.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and everybody be sure to check her personal information and find out if you can see her here in our area. Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Berry, and the book is Recipes for a Beautiful Life, a Memoir in Stories. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.